to affect field theories within the standard model, right? And some of the key points that we saw are that effective field theories give you a systematic expansion for interactions at low energies, that symmetry dictates those interactions. You can do this, work the symmetry thing both from the top down and from the bottom up, right? So if you're a theorist and you know what's going on in some UV theory and you want to make predictions for the infrared theory at lower scales, and you know the symmetries, then you can impose those symmetries on the infrared. You get a restriction on the Lagrangian. And you have more control over what's going on as a result of it. If, on the other hand, so in the case where we're looking at effective theories within the standard model, we know the standard model, that's the situation we're in. The other situation is that you are a lowly infrared person. You're measuring this Lagrangian. And you don't know what's up above because we've never had the energy to produce those particles. We don't know what the fundamental symmetries of the theory are. We do know something about the gauge symmetries. The gauge symmetries that we have in the infrared should be maintained in the ultraviolet. But we don't know anything about what global symmetries might or might not be preserved up there, beyond the ones that are respected in the infrared. We look at the effective operators and use them as a guide. And so I'll give one very concrete example of that is proton decay in the standard model, right? So when we're going from the infrared to the UV, we look at operators. Now proton decay, this is things like you can have a proton going to a pion and decaying to a pion and a positron. Now, this doesn't happen very often. The lifetime quoted in the PDG, I think, is something like, what is it? Do you remember? 10 to the 30 some years. So, upper bound. So the width is less than that. Very rare process. There are operators in the standard model, effective operators that we can write down. I won't write them down because you're going to write them down in your problem set this week. But figuring out that the fact that this is a very long lifetime means that those operators are suppressed by some very large cutoff scale. And you can ask, what symmetries do these operators have in common? What symmetries do these operators break? That implies something about the symmetries of the high scale theory. It may not be a unique prediction, but at least gives you a very strong hint about what kinds of symmetries the high scale theory continues to respect. Okay, and the other thing we saw was this notion, I didn't use the word, but this notion of matching an effective field theory. So in the Fermi model, we were able to calculate coefficients of an effective field theory, of the effective field theory. Yeah.
So you said that there are effective operators in the standard model. By that you mean non-randomizable operators.
Yes.
Are there in principle an infinite number of those operators? Or?
Good. There are in principle an infinite number of higher dimension. So let's say I specify the field content of the standard model. I've got my QUD. I'll use my right-handed conjugate fields, these my matter, my gauge bosons, my Higgs. There's an infinite number of operators that I can build out of these, but we've already seen that there's a finite number with dimension less than or equal to 4. Those are the ones that we usually call the standard model. And if you set any other cutoff, if you ask what are the ones with dimension less than or equal to 6, or if you ask what are the ones with dimension equals 5, there's basically one type. Dimension 6, there's 80, and so on. The numbers get bigger. But now, if we have new physics entering at some scale, say 10 TeV, right? Then the dimension 6 operators are suppressed by 10 TeV squared. The dimension 8 operators are suppressed by 10 TeV to the fourth. And so we'll see smaller and smaller effects at low energies from the higher and higher dimension operators. So for practical calculations, it's enough. So we saw there's a natural ordering, and you focus power, dimension by dimension on each set of operators. Now that, one of the things we'll talk about today is that that's not the only thing that matters. It's not necessarily true that all dimension six operators are equally observable, or that dimension six operators are harder to see than a different dimension five operator. It's not just the dimension, it's also how observable, how striking the process is, and how different it is from what happens in the standard model itself. So I'll keep that vague for now, make it more precise later. But this is a very natural ranking and categorization to use, and at any stage in the ranking, you have a finite number of operators. And once you, if you were to measure or measure all of the operators up to dimension six, you could then do a controlled calculation up to a fixed order in energies, including those new physics effects. All right, so as a warm-up to thinking about the standard model as an effective theory, which is the goal for much of the next week, I want to start with a little toy theory. Doesn't have all of that matter. I'm just going to simplify to think about a theory with just two vial fermions, so one Dirac fermion. And I'm going to say there's a global symmetry, just a global U1 symmetry. So I'm going to define my psi right conjugate and my psi left. So these are each two component spinners. This one will have charge plus one. This one will have charge minus one. Okay, so I can think of these. If I imagine this as being an electric charge, somehow sort of morally the analog of my electric charge, then this would be my E left, and this would be my E right conjugate field. Okay, but not gauging it, not yet anyway, global symmetry, two fermions, that's it. So we know that the Lagrangian, the kinetic part, should have its psi left sigma dot del psi left bar, if I think an I in front, psi right sigma dot del psi right, both conjugate, bars. And then I can write down some mass terms. I'm going to make these massless fermions for simplicity. And then some interaction potential that can depend on psi left and psi right. So now we can ask, what can be in this V interaction consistent with the symmetries? So I've already decided there's not going to be a mass term. So the next most complicated thing we could think about is we can build things out of four of the fermion fields, right? And now since I'm working with four fermion fields, I'm going to drop the size and just call these L and RC, because otherwise I'll have to write psi like 100 times, and so will you. So what are some of the operators that we could write down? Well. So, all right, one operator for someone who's not a TA. Sorry. And then, plus the conjugate. Is that what you wanted? Okay. So this is a correct way of, this is a math term in the notation you're much more used to, which is the Dirac notation, right? So let me actually back up. In terms of these Weyl fermions, it's very counterintuitive when you're used to Dirac fermions. The way you would write the mass term is actually this way. So two left-handed fermions can be contracted together. And then you'd also write the Hermitian conjugate. So how much have you guys actually done with Weyl fermions? Okay, because I know. So you've done this. Okay. They both have two components. If you write two, can be thought of as having two complex components. But usually Majorana is often written as four real components. Here we have two complex components. So the way to think about it, by the way, is just that if these things both have, so there's two types of SU2 indices. Left-handed spinners have an index that they're usually represented by indices with and without dots. Okay, so this is just notation. So left-handed spinners, like psi left, have an alpha index. Right-handed spinners, like the complex conjugate, psi left bar, have a dotted index. Okay, these just correspond to two different SU2 groups. There's an SU2 that acts on the left-handed spinners and an SU2 that acts on the right-handed spinners. So these are different types of indices, and there's no invariant that can contract them, because they just live in different groups. I can write down sigma matrices. Sigma matrices have one dotted and one undotted index. I can write also a sigma bar index matrix, which is just the conjugate of that, and has an alpha dot beta. And then it's an SU2, so there's also an invariant, epsilon alpha beta, just the usual definition of an epsilon. It's one for alpha equals 1, beta equals 2, minus 1 for alpha equals 2, beta equals 1, and 0 for alpha equals beta. And then you can similarly write down an epsilon alpha dot beta dot. So with these, how do you build invariants out of spinners? So Lorentz invariants shouldn't have mu's, shouldn't have alphas, and shouldn't have alpha dots. So I can write down a psi left alpha, psi left beta, epsilon alpha beta, and just with one spinner. This looks like maybe it should vanish because epsilon's anti-symmetric in the indices, but these are fermion fields, they anti-commute. And so if you ask, well, that's equal to psi left alpha, so you'd say this is equal to psi left alpha, psi left beta, epsilon beta alpha with a minus sign, but then that's in turn equal to psi left beta, psi left alpha with a minus sign because they anti-commute, epsilon beta alpha minus 1, and so that's just the same thing, psi left beta, psi left alpha, epsilon beta alpha. So there's no, that's the kind of argument you would use to show that that it vanishes by symmetry, right? As you just use this anti-symmetry of the epsilon and then try to rewrite it as itself with a minus sign. But I got two minus signs. I rewrote it as itself with a plus sign. I haven't shown that anything's zero. I could do the same thing. So this is usually written as psi left, just as psi left, psi left. Just notation. The other thing that I can do with the psi bars, this term, as I've written it with two psi lefts, it's called a Majorana mass because I just took, and I can only write this down. This is only, if my psi carried a charge, then this would carry, like in this example, this would carry charge 2, right? Well, in this example, minus 2. So I'm never going to get this times the q left, right? The charge of the psi left. I'm never going to get something like this in a Lagrangian by itself unless psi is neutral. If psi is neutral under all symmetries, then I can write down psi left in the Lagrangian. And then a term m psi left is called a Majorana mass. Because it makes, and this is distinct from the usual masses. So the usual mass that we would write in this notation, and then again, I'd have to write down in the Lagrangian that plus his Hermitian conjugate. The other thing I can do using exactly the same operations but both spinners is this. Okay, so this is a Majorana mass, this is a Dirac mass. Again, plus Hermitian conjugate. Here I need both the left-handed particle and the right-handed antiparticle involved in the mass term, right? So this forces me to now, instead of just one two-component spinner, I have two two-component spinners. That's equivalent to the four-component spinner that we're used to using. Here you have the particle, and it's just squared. So it's like the particle is its own antiparticle. There's no need to introduce a second particle. That's the Majorana mass case, which we'll talk more about probably Tuesday or Wednesday when I get to neutrinos. This is the Dirac kind of mass term that we're familiar with. And then the other kind of object that we frequently write down is this one here, right? So I've used a sigma matrix. So now if I expand out the indices, what I have there is a sigma left alpha, sigma mu alpha beta dot. Now I can contract that dotted into index into a psi bar, which has a dotted index, and then add in a del mu in here to contract that into. Okay, so this is also now, because I have a psi and a psi bar, this has charge 0, regardless of the charges of psi left and of the charge of psi left, because the psi left and the psi left bar cancel. Whereas something like a psi left sigma mu alpha beta dot del mu psi right conjugate bar, that in our example would have charge minus one, so charge minus 2. So this wouldn't be in the Lagrangian. So sorry, I just wanted to go through this because I realized that it's probably been a while since you've looked at this math. There's actually a huge, like several hundred page set of notes on the archive that I can post to the wiki on two-component spinner math for those that and just all the identities that are used. There's also a very nice two-page summary we should probably scan the end of Wessenbagger, which has a much, much shorter summary with almost everything you need on this stuff. But so hopefully this is enough of a refresher for today's discussion. So I'll just keep that here. So this is good. Aside from all the bars being in different places than what we, because then you'd use for the standard Weyl notation, this is a perfectly good operator. Has charge minus one, plus one, charge 0. But I want for now to focus, actually assume that this is zero. And that's just by my decree. And talk about operators that have actually two of each. Okay? So the simplest thing I can do is just multiply this guy by himself. Right? So I can take this psi left, psi right conjugate, square him. And now that's an operator. Has each one of these has dimension 3/2, so the whole operator has dimension 6. And this is one thing that we would look for as an interaction in our theory with only these two fermions. It's a higher dimension operator, right? So it has to come from somewhere. If I give it a coefficient, 1 over lambda squared, and let me call it C1 over lambda squared, and I should add his Hermitian conjugate, then at a scale, let's say C1 is order 1, then if I do scattering at low energies of these psi particles at low energies, I'm going to get a very weak scattering, right? It's going to be suppressed. The matrix elements are going to be suppressed by energy squared over lambda squared. So the cross sections will be suppressed by lambda to the 4th. But as I go to higher energies than lambda, that stops looking like a suppression. It starts looking like a very strong interaction. And something has to resolve that and explain that in the theory. The theory wouldn't, as written, wouldn't make sense. At energies greater than about lambda. There should probably be a 4 pi here. Strictly speaking, below 4 pi lambda, you still have some control. But this is the cutoff scale at which you need, if you're going to have a consistent theory above that energy, which we probably do, then this has to be resolved. It can be resolved by adding lots of things. So we'll see how easy it is to generate all of these operators by just postulating some heavier particles interacting with these psi. So this is one case. Another thing I can write down is just, I'll add a C2 over lambda squared in front of it, a psi left, psi right conjugate, and now I'll multiply him by his complex conjugate. Okay, so this is a different operator. I just, instead of squaring it, I conjugate squared it. So anything else I should be writing down? All right, so first I will suggest, this one's a bit of a trick operator. You might ask, well, how much here, right, when I draw these parentheses around it, what I really mean is that I'm contracting his alpha index into his alpha index, okay? Or the way I was writing it before, this is an upper index lowered with an epsilon tensor. I could imagine instead taking, so let me write it just with everybody having an upper index. So this guy is gamma, this guy is delta. So the above operator, I could have written as an epsilon alpha gamma epsilon beta delta. And you might say, well, wait a minute, isn't there a different operator where I take these same fermions and just contract them differently? Say an epsilon alpha beta epsilon gamma delta. Are these two separate operators? Certainly looks like they should be. But it turns out that clearly the alpha gamma and the beta delta contraction is the same as the alpha, delta, beta, gamma, right? And then these three combinations of epsilons satisfy identities. And so it turns out that this guy is actually a linear combination. I think there's some kind of minus a half factor or something like that, but I don't remember which direction, that relates this contraction to the upper contraction. So this is actually not an independent operator that we have to write down. Okay, so this is this guy, what you might call, sorry if I erased that too quickly for anybody, what in this notation I would have called psi left, psi right conjugate, is actually equivalent. So I don't need to write him down as an independent operator. So let me erase this indexed out guy. Okay, there's some qualitatively different operators. So here I've written down operators that have only left, that have two lefts and two rights, whether they're barred or not. Can ask, can I make an operator out of all lefts? And you can. So I can write down a psi left bar. That's a real operator, and because these guys each have charge minus one, these guys each have charge plus one, whole operator's neutral. There's also the right version of him. And right, then you might ask, well, what about things like, say I can take these kinetic terms and square them, right? So I have a psi left, but I'm not going to put the derivatives in, because now I have two of them. So I can make a Lorentz invariant by that, right? Just contracting the two sigma indices into each other. Once again, there are identities that I can use here to bring them back into the form without sigma matrices. So when we're classifying these effective operators, you can pretty much always write them, as long as they just involve fermions, rather than fermions and scalars or fermions and vectors. You can always choose by convention to write, well, something with four left-handed spinners, you can always write this way. Something with two left-handed and two right-handed, you can either write in this form or in this form. And it's a choice. Because we're always just talking about contracting two sigma matrices together, and then you can use, again, what are called Fiertz identities to rewrite it in this form. So for now, to keep things minimal, I'm just going to write everything in terms of products without any sigma matrices. The conventional thing when working in the standard model is actually, because we're largely thinking about operators generated by vector interactions, is to keep these sigma matrices around. So we would usually see operators like this in the standard model classified this way rather than this way, but the two are closely related. Okay, so these are basically the operators that we need to worry about in this theory. I don't think I left any of them out, although I may have. Now, thought that wasn't working for a second. Now, it's not hard to see where these operators come from. So we can just go quickly through a few examples of interactions with heavy particles. And it's very easy to tell at tree level, when you generate these at tree level, what operators you get out from a certain heavy particle. So for example, there's the case we looked at yesterday, the interactions with a vector. There, we have some A mu, this A is going to be heavy, times a product that looks like a psi left, sigma dot del, psi left bar, say minus, if their gauge, if their charge under this A is equal to their global charge, although that's a choice, in principle that could be different. So actually, let me just write down alpha 1 or Q1, Q left plus a Q minus Q right. That way, Q right is the charge of the right-handed particle rather than the charge of the left of the left-handed antiparticle, because that's just hard to keep straight. So I'll call it minus Q right times psi right conjugate sigma dot del. Sorry, I didn't want those derivatives there, did I? So right, this is A dot del in the interactions. So my Lagrangian with the vector contains this. When I integrate the vector out, what I'm going to get is current squared. So if I called this whole guy here J mu, I'm just going to get coupling squared over the mass of the vector squared times J mu, G mu nu, J nu, right? And so what kinds of interactions is this going to give me? It's going to give me psi left sigma. So this is where I'm going to drop the size for my own sanity. Sorry. Left sigma left bar squared plus, and I mean, they each clearly have coefficients. Q squared, Q left squared, 2 Q left, Q right, left sigma left bar, right sigma right bar. And a Q right squared, right sigma right bar squared, right? Those three types of terms. And then I can use the touted identities there to just swap it out to the only other thing that's, I mean, you don't even need to, if you want the coefficient, you need to remember an identity. If you don't care about the coefficient, you just need to remember that there is an identity. There's only one possible Lorentz invariant thing that you could write that doesn't have sigma matrices, right? Here it's LL, L bar, L bar. So up to some coefficient of proportionality, an LRC, L bar, RC bar, and an RC, RC bar squared. And those are the three operators that you get. Yeah. It can be important. So depending on, for example, one example of a question where it's very important whether these have the same sign or opposite signs is if you're asking, let's say that this actually did have a mass. If you were asking about non-relativistic scattering, you would either get a cancellation or an enhancement of the charge, of the effective cross-section for the non-relativistic scattering based on whether that in the case Q right equals minus Q left, you would get a suppression of low velocity scattering. So it can be important for certain applications, mainly in the non-relativistic limit. In the relativistic limit, you can really think of the left-handed particle and the right-handed particle as completely independent beasts whose interactions don't mix very much. So interference is never really important. And since I took the mass to zero, I can do that. I can think about them as independent. I'll always be scattering polarization states. And so I won't care about this interference. But it can be important when you do consider interference. So that's the vector case. Now, let's say I have a neutral scalar. Real scalar, so I'm going to add so my scalar phi has to couple to something that's neutral and has no indices. So the only choice is it's basically something proportional to the mass term that I chose not to write. This plus, so that's some lambda, plus lambda star times the same phi, because phi is real, psi right conjugate bar, psi left bar. Okay? And now I have this. When I integrate it out, I am just going to get, so I can call this, I can define an object J with no indices to be just lambda psi left psi right conjugate plus this conjugate. And in terms of that J, I'm just doing that so that I can write down one simple shorthand expression. The effect of Lagrangian that I get from integrating out a scalar, if I did exactly the same procedure of integrating, of completing the square and then integrating over the scalar in the path integral, and just keeping the current term that's left over, I'd get something very similar to that. I'd get a 1 over m phi squared times j squared. So that's going to give me, I'll have a lambda star squared psi left bar psi right conjugate bar squared. Plus I'll have, just looking at the wrong guy. Let me start from the left. And so this plus the Hermitian conjugate plus, now I have also a real term, psi left, psi right conjugate, psi left bar, psi right conjugate bar. Now, if we compare these interactions to the vector interactions, we see some differences, right? This guy, every interaction involves a psi left, psi, two psi lefts, either conjugated or not, and two psi rights, all possible conjugations. So for example, this left bar never arises from a scalar. Here, you see, I always have the same number of conjugated, of right-handed fermions and left-handed fermions fields in the interaction, right? I've got LL, L bar, I always have one left-handed product, one right, sorry. Here's where it gets confusing. I have L's and R's, but I always have two barred fields. So what I mean, the barred fields are really the right-handed spinner fields, but they may be for right-handed particles, they may be for right-handed antiparticles. So the right-handed, I'll go through some examples of the particle antiparticle actual scattering processes in just a moment. But it's clear you're getting very different coupling structures. So if you can figure out how to measure the coefficient of this operator, in particular, if you can measure the coefficient of this operator, and you can measure, which doesn't appear over here from the scalar, and you measure the coefficient of, say, this operator here, which doesn't arise from a vector, then you can tell whether, you know, if you see this, you know it's not coming from a neutral scalar. Could be coming from a vector. If you see this, you know it's not coming from a vector. And so you can build up from the pattern of the effect of operators what kinds of physics you have. Yeah,
Deborah? How easy is it to measure holicity states?
Measuring holicity states in a high energy process is actually quite easy. Producing them, because you're just, it depends exactly on the context. Yeah. I mean, so generally what you want to do is set up a situation where, say, you're putting them through a magnetic field. That just bends them depending on their charge. But you can end up doing, you can do more sophisticated measurements to see how they interact further, say, after that. So you can have them interact with light. And there's in something like the LHC, I should say you're not measuring helicities of electron final states. The other thing you can do is if you're producing particles that then decay, you can often look at the kinematics of the decay products to tell what helicity states you're producing. So it's not trivial, but one can certainly engineer experiments that measure these polarizations. At really high energies, if you're trying to distinguish these at, you know, at LHC energies for the mass of the electron, you're looking for such rare processes that it can be very hard. So actually, I don't know of anything that can do it in that context. But at low energies, it can be done. Okay, so the other thing, as I'll show you, is just there's different patterns of what you produce from the same initial state. So you can prepare a polarized beam, and then of electrons, two polarized beams of electrons, and depending on the angles at which different final states are produced, you can also gain some information about the structure of the state. Okay, just to be clear though, this is not like a clear vector versus scalar differentiator, because you could also consider, say, a charge 2 scalar, I'll give them charge plus 2. So now I'll call him phi 2. He can have a coupling to psi left, plus lambda prime, psi 2, psi right conjugate bar, psi right conjugate bar, plus Hermitian conjugate. And now this, when I integrate them out, now I have, so I can define, sorry, let me write it this way. So psi 2 times the whole thing, I'm going to call him J2. Then my L effective would be a J2 J2 star over the mass squared. And here you see you're going to get exactly the operator I highlighted before as coming from the vector. So there are different patterns of different combinations that you would get from different operators, but there is overlap. There's nothing that I can say this would only come from a vector or this would only come from a scalar. But each type has its own distinctive pattern of operators that it produces. So, okay, one thing worth saying at this point, let me modify my theory a little bit and imagine that I added, so here I had a massive vector. Suppose I also had a massless photon that coupled to that precisely that U1 symmetry. So now the processes mediated by these operators have a tree level piece in their matrix element, right? So now when I look at the matrix element, and for example, this is a process that takes two left-handed electrons. One thing that it does is it takes two left-handed electrons to two left-handed electrons. Okay. Where I'm now using my sort of particle, I've identified psi left as creating left-handed electrons, just so that I have familiar particle names to talk about. So now this has two pieces. It has a piece from my effective operator, my q left squared over mv squared, plus it's also going to have a piece coming from my massless photon, and that's going to have a charge squared over energy squared with some angular dependence, right? So I've got both of these. Now that means two things. First of all, it means that my cross section benefits from an interference term. Right, the cross section for that scattering process starts from an e to the fourth, I'm dropping pi's, over e squared, plus a q squared over m squared. Versus, well, plus, then there's, I'll only write down the non-interference term, q squared e squared. There's a q to the fourth e squared over mv to the fourth. This is the term we'd have if there were no vector in the theory, which could be very striking, even though it's highly suppressed. This could be the most striking thing you could see if this process of electron-electron scattering didn't happen in your low energy theory, right? If the only, if this process was forbidden by, had this process been forbidden in your low energy theory, the fact that it happened at all, even with a very small rate, would tell you that you have this operator and you'd be very sensitive to that. When you have a standard model process, meaning a low energy process coming from that photon that it can interfere with, you get a larger signal because you get this interference signal. But you also get a much larger background because now you're trying to distinguish with precision the shape of the scattering cross section at high energies rather than just looking for any scattering at all. So it's a bit of a trade-off. Sometimes one can be very sensitive to things because of standard model interference, but at the same time, it sort of limits how much the precision that you can get because there's you're trying to measure a small deviation from something that's not zero. All right, so what are some of the, so now I want to move from this model, right? I hope, so this was mainly to give you an idea of how an exhaustive classification can work and how the operators in the low energy theory are related to whatever physics is happening in the high energy theory. Yeah. Yeah, right, so this mv squared, yeah, so this was for a massive vector, thank you. If it had been a massless vector, I would still have this kind of interaction, but it would be suppressed by a normal massless propagator instead of having this one over mass squared. Right, that's why this e squared has an energy denominator. All right, so what are some of the operators in the standard model that we're interested in, right? I just used this to demonstrate that, well, you know, some operators are going to be sensitive to very high scales because they involve very rare processes that have no standard model counterpart. Some processes are a little bit harder to set bounds on. Obviously, we look for the things and try to mine as much as we can from the things that are really, really unique and distinctive outside the standard model. So a few examples in the standard model. So d equals 4. I'll just go dimension by dimension. And it's actually kind of odd because I'm going to go from lowest dimension to highest, and then in the rest of the course, I'm actually going to go from dimension 6 back down to dimension 4. Is the order I'll be covering these in. So dimension 4, we say, the standard model as you've written it in the class is the most general dimension for Lagrangian that you can write down with some parameters chosen. That's almost true. There's one very important operator that we didn't talk about. So the dimension 4 Lagrangian is the one you learned in the standard model. Plus, there's one extra type of term that you might want to add, which is, so you're used to having, say, for the gluon, a g mu nu interaction, right? This is your kinetic term. But what if instead we're living in four dimensions? What if instead I lowered his indices and contracted those with an epsilon tensor? So this is another dimension 4 operator. You know, we've been taught we should put some coefficient in front of it, see what it is. measure that. These are operators. In the case of gluons, these lead to nuclear dipole moments. These are very well measured and very small. So the value of this G prime seems to be about 10 to the minus 9, which is the smallest dimensionless number in the standard model, as far as we know, even smaller than the electron Yukawa. Yeah. No. Yeah, so thank you. Sorry, it is bounded by 10 to the minus 9. It could be 0. We don't know why it's 0. There's some ideas for why it might be measured as 0, even if it had some generic thing. So this is the so-called strong CP problem. It's not a higher dimension operator, so it's a bit outside of the theme of this lecture. But I figured I should mention it since it's there, or it should be there. We haven't seen it, and it's one of the problems we'll be talking about later. At dimension 5, as I mentioned, there's only one type of operator that you can write down. How would I get dimension 5 from fermions, scalars, and vectors? Basically, I want two fermions and two bosons. Right? I could try building things with two fermions and two derivatives, or two fermions and one boson and one derivative. But I actually don't really get anything new at that level. This is the thing. This turns out to be the only non-trivial thing that I can write down. And there's only one combination here that's gauge invariant. I just take my lepton field and a Higgs field, or an H star field, depending on how you've... I'm going to contract their SU2 indices. That gives me something that's gauge neutral, because the lepton and the Higgs, those are both doublets. I've contracted their doublet indices, and they have opposite hypercharges, the way I've written it. But this guy still has an SU2 index, a spinner index. Right? Now I can contract him. Into another guy with an epsilon alpha beta. So these are SU2 weak, and this is a spin contraction of the lepton indices. That's the only interaction I can write down. I expect it to have some cutoff suppression. There's three flavors of lepton here. Put in an I. Three flavors of lepton there. They can have a coefficient that depends on I and J. And when I take these Higgses to their VEV, I'm going to pick up a Cij V squared, where V is the Higgs VEV, over lambda, times just the neutrino part, nu left I, nu left J. That's the same operator I wrote down earlier when we were talking about Majorana masses. So this is an operator that can give rise to neutrino masses. It can give rise to small neutrino masses, which is interesting because the neutrino masses are observed to be very small. We actually don't know what the absolute scale of their mass is, but there is a bound on this type of mass should be less than about, I think, it's sub-EV. I think it's like a 20th of an EV, but I'm very, very much not sure of the number at the moment. There's some model-independent bounds on the mass that are higher, regardless of whether it's Majorana or Dirac. And we know that the differences in mass squared are on the order of a few millielectron volts squared. These are much, much smaller than the other masses we're used to encountering in the standard model. And this is one very good candidate to explain why they're so small. Now at dimension 6. Sorry. Yeah.
Delta M, what is delta M?
Oh, sorry. So what I mean is if you take the neutrino mass matrix, right, so it's got, appears to have quite a few non-zero components. If you look at the three eigenvalues and ask what are their pairwise differences, they're of this scale. All right. Dimension six. So I mentioned this is really the only operator we have to worry about at dimension five. At dimension six, I'm not going to classify them all because there's actually 80 operators. You can build operators out of scalars and vectors, scalars and fermions, three vectors. The three vector ones are things like g mu nu cubed with appropriate tensor contractions, etc. But again, we've tended to focus on particular ones because they're very, because we have ways of testing them that are very opportune, very sensitive ways of testing them. So one example is proton decay. Again, you'll have a homework dedicated to that. Another example is, let me just write down the following operator. So that's an operator that leads to muon decay. Muons already decay, but this would lead to a very rare muon decay. Usually we have muons decaying through the Fermi interaction to an electron, electron antineutrino, and a muon neutrino. Here, this makes the muon decay into three electrons. And so if you have a bunch of muons in your experiment, you can do a very precise search for this operator. And there are excellent bounds on this process. So far, haven't seen it yet. That gives you a bound on that scale. Other things you can do with muon decay, you can also write down, say, I'll use left-handed muons this time, sigma mu nu, this is just a sigma mu sigma bar nu, oh, I'll just write it out in full. Mu left bar, and then you can contract that into an F mu nu. And that operator gives you a muon decay to an electron and a photon, which is also very well searched for. There's also a very tight bound on this cutoff scale. And then the case we'll talk about in the next lecture, it's actually very different. It's an operator that happens in the standard model that doesn't, so you might think, oh, well, that can't be good for anything. But it's also a very powerful constraint on mu physics. Operators that involve, say, strange quark, down quark, squared, again, 1 over lambda squared. So this doesn't violate any symmetries that the standard model doesn't violate, right? It has baryon number 0. It has, you know, some flavor structure, but the standard model has flavor structure too. But even though this is non-zero in the standard model, it's actually really tiny. It's tiny enough that by looking for measuring it this rate precisely, you can actually get bounds on the cutoff that are of order 10 to the 3 TeV. So that's the mystery that I want to talk about next time. First of all, why would you expect operators like this to be generated at all? What's the absence of this telling us? I mean, this is an interesting scale for probing something like supersymmetry because we would expect superpartners to be well below this scale. Right, so what's it telling us about new physics? And then also just the sort of basic question of why in the heck, when we have this process in the standard model, why is it so small that we're sensitive to 10 to the 3 TeV processes when the standard model has like hundreds of GeV as the highest scale in it? So I'll talk both about why this is small in the standard model and why it might not be small beyond the standard model and is an important constraint. This will be the example that I focus on next time. All right. Sorry I went a little bit late. Any questions at this point?
So this is a bit of a formal question. So you, when you said, you know, you're dealing with left-handed or right-handed well fermions, you know, you kept referring to them as SU2, which is basically, you know, the Lorentz group breaking up into, I guess, SU2 left and SU2 right.
Right.
My question is that these representations of the Lorentz group, which is the left-handed over right-handed, are they what's the word? Are they faithful representations?
So they're all, you mean like versus projective representations? I mean, so all fermion representations in a sense are have a minus one,
right,
under rotations. In that sense, they're not faithful. Now, the other question you can ask is, are they sort of, is if you have a state, if you have these fields, right, do they mix into one another under Lorentz transformations, the left-handed and the right-handed? You know? And for massless particles, they don't. The only thing, I mean, you see in the field theory, the only thing that mixes them is the mass term. For massive states, you can never talk about, unless you're in the Majorana case, with a Dirac mass, you can never talk about a left and a right-handed separately. They always mix. And that's a very physical thing. You can picture the particle at rest, and you know that if you're that spin up, right? There's no sense in which it can have spin aligned or anti-aligned with its momentum because it has no three momentum. Spin up, spin down is a matter of convention of what you want to call up and down. So there can't possibly be any distinction between the two spin states. You can rotate them into one another. Let me just ask in general, is the pace good, fast, slow, just confusing, not sure why I'm saying what I'm saying? How's it going?
I think the question is sort of good.
Yeah.
At the equals four, aren't there any other operators that introduce mass to the nucleus?
If you add more fields, there can be. But if you just use the five standard model matter fields, the QUDLE, you can't write down a dimension five mass for the neutrino. You need to introduce a right-handed neutrino in order to do that. Yeah, so are you guys just being quiet because it's Friday or because you're not sure why I'm bothered with all this stuff? Or
It's Friday?
All right.
It's Friday morning.
I know.
At the 9 o'clock class, all this stuff.
Friday morning for me too. I get it.